outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Chain.
Have you seen Green Book yet?
No, you mentioned it.
Yeah, interesting movie. Sarah and I saw it last night. Our son saw it and said, hey, you guys got to check it out. So Sarah and I went for our pre-Valentine's Day date. So you could tell that we got our threefer in, since this is airing in March sometime. But yeah, we went and saw Green Book, story of a black concert pianist and kind of a white Italian New York Brooklyn guy traveling in the South together. One's the driver for the other. This is back in the 60s, I think.
Okay.
And yeah, interesting movie, great story, human connection, understanding each other past all kinds of diversity issues. Lovely. And
wow.
For the book I was working on, it was very touching, and Sarah and I enjoyed it very much. Some good humor in it, and yeah, a little poking around, a little violence now and then. So.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
What was the emotional takeaway?
Oh, I'd hate to ruin it for people. Just people have to get outside themselves when they get with somebody that's different from both sides. It's a flip, right? It's the black guy is the kind of the celebrity, and the white guy is the manual worker, and they're going in the South where it's just not allowed.
That should be the opposite, yeah.
Yeah, and so they both suffer from their own people, quote unquote. At the same time, they're finding connection with each other, and pretty cool.
Nice.
Yeah, so that might be something to check out. I'm Wayne Jacobson, by the way.
I'm Brad Cummings.
This is a threefer, so we're doing it about 3 weeks earlier than you're hearing it. 4 weeks. No, 3 weeks earlier.
Yeah, but you travel.
Yeah, you're traveling. I'm traveling. I'm going to, it doesn't matter where I'm going because we're done. I'm already back.
We're back, baby.
So if you didn't check the travel schedule and I was right next door, I apologize for that. So got this email the other day, though. I thought I'd throw it up with you. Jeff asked us this from the blog, actually on the blog, and it's after the last podcast, but this is probably at least 4 months old.
Okay. I'll remember something.
Back in my performance days, a friend was killed in a car accident, leaving two young children and his wife. It was my wake-up call to get serious. So I knew, because of what I was taught by my not-really-called pastor type, that if you wanted to be serious about the Christian life, you should drop your nets and follow him. Full-time service. So I started to look to going into ministry. I then met a guy that supports pastor types that have been run over, worn out, hurt, etc. And he told me, if you can do anything else, do not become a pastor. I am glad that God I'm glad that God put me next to him at that event. That was a pivotal time on my journey. What gives with all of the pastor types that were not really called to being something that isn't real? Are any of you really called to anything, or is God just working the pressures that come from our culture and we think of them as callings? Interesting question.
Why do we, I don't know. It's like we put the whole pastor thing in a bizarre category. I don't know that it's supposed to have been that way.
No, I'm sure it was not. I just say that because I, 16 years of age, I went forward feeling called to the ministry at the church I was in. And I look back now at it just, I don't know how to look at it. I don't know that I'd use the word in the same way today, because I don't think I can be called to the ministry any more than you can be called to be a plumber or called to be anything else. I mean, in some cases, it's a vocational choice, regretfully. I wouldn't think leadership in the kingdom of God would be a vocational choice.
Well, I mean, it's weird because I'm pretty sure that when you read about it in scriptures, we're not talking about, oh, I want you as one of the professional paycheck guys. I'm pretty sure that's not what called into the ministry is about.
Well, it was in my day, let me tell you.
No, I know. The point of it. But we've made that, and it's like that is. It's like if you're really serious about God, then you should, you know, the expectation is, well, then you should do this full time, and you know, you should be one of those like official guys.
Yeah, but you're like asking people to do that when they're like 16, 17, 18, 19, because you got to go get your degree.
They do not have much life under their belt. And what is it that they really have as tested wisdom that they know?
And is it just a desire to be on the stage? I don't know for me that it wasn't. If I have to be here every Sunday morning, I'm glad I found out that I didn't later in life. But if I have to be here every Sunday morning, I decided I'd be more engaged up there in the pulpit than I would be sitting here in the pew. And I don't know that it was more than that.
I imagine it was in view of the fullness of who you've become and what you're doing. Because I do think that God actually picks individuals And he gives them to the body as a gift. I do believe that out of Ephesians.
Yeah, no, he sets people apart for things. Yeah, yeah,
I agree. And it's like, and he gifts and wires them in a way that they can be an effective gift of developing and helping the rest of the body to become. But it's bizarre how we have put that up on a pedestal thing. We've raised that up to some exalted place that I'm going like, that's part of the problem because we've twisted it in doing so. If it was just understood as a focus of servanthood unto a community of people,
yeah,
and I gave myself with intentionality going like, I get it. That's what you've asked me to do. That's what you gifted me to do. I will do that with all my heart as worship unto you. But we've elevated it into a you're more special than, or has most people end up feeling it, oh, that guy's more valuable than.
Yeah.
And absolutely, it comes with a whole entourage of preference that further twists it into something bizarre that I doubt that the little guy, 16-year-old was responding to going, oh, I want the special goodies and I want to be the super guy. I mean, maybe there are some that do that. Maybe.
But yeah, I think there's an attractiveness to it in that way. I do.
I would love to believe that there's more people responding with the genuineness of that sense of call than it is the lust for that position of privilege.
But I've met both.
Yes, true.
I've met people in that place because they did have a genuine gift, and that's the only place they knew to vest it and got lost in it. And I know people who are there without that gift who love being in charge.
Yes.
Love having the golden
glitter. Yes, I have sadly met them too.
Yeah, it happens for both, I think.
And but that's the thing that's frustrating to me is going like, why, as opposed to just normal living life with an awareness of how I can be of service to the rest of the community, I don't understand why we have put the paid professional thing on it, because I'm pretty sure the priesthood was not God's idea.
It's not only the paid professional thing. It's also what you described, I'll call it the pedestaling thing. It also is the holding up and exalting of that person.
Of the man of God.
Which when you were talking about a minute ago, I flashed back to, did you ever see the miniseries, was it The Queen? Or
yes.
Yeah. And Queen Elizabeth, when she was like 15, 16, 17, whatever, she became Queen of England. Remember that?
Yeah.
And they have this investiture service. I forget what they call it, a coronation. And one of the old guys says at the end of it, the coordination is how you turn a girl into a goddess. And I thought, whoa, that's what this is. That's what clergy is and ordination. That's what coronation is for royalty. It's to take someone just like you and me, they may be even gifted or may in the sense of the queen has just inherited it. So, but in the sense of the church, and I used air quotes that you can't see because this is a podcast, not a video thing. sorry. But in the terms of it really is to take just a normal person and elevate them to junior status just under God for whatever authority they think they need, for whatever status they think they need. And people kind of treat them
different. They do.
I'm thinking about this. It's funny because in one way, yeah, they kind of, you know, give deference to you now as the head of their church kind of thing. On the other hand, they skewer you in their conversations for not measuring up to whatever they think you should be. So there's kind of like Moses. It's like Moses sending to the mountain. It's bull. We'll do everything you say. No, not really, but we'll pretend that you're a guy closer to God. See, when we need that, and then we'll skewer you when we need to do that.
It would be my conclusion that the priesthood is what God settled for, as opposed to something that he wanted. You know, that indirectness of, hey, we don't want that face-to-face relationship. Moses, you be that guy.
Right.
That isn't what God wanted. God wanted to relate to each and every one of them directly.
And Moses wanted that too. Would that all God's people could prophesy.
Yes.
He was praying for these elder types.
And it took quite a while to get to the New Testament concept of the priesthood of all believers that is still just a concept. It's not like even the Reformation.
It's great words.
It's great words. It's never been embraced. And I end up going like, how frustrating that must be for a human perspective of God.
not sure.
Like, it's like I'm pretty sure God's not up in heaven, just totally frustrated. But I look at that going like,
God kind of knew better, maybe.
We have warped this into an indirect deal that not only distances us from the fellowship and intimacy that we're meant to walk in, but it twists whoever is seduced and succumbed into that pedestal role. Because now they live under a false image, an unreal set of expectations of people to somehow mediate God to them. That you're just going, they're not supposed to do that.
Which, and it's not even a matter of they're not supposed to do that. It's also a matter of that's not a real thing. Right?
I would agree.
It's not, you're doing something you're not supposed to do. That isn't the thing. When you're doing that, you are playing
a surrogate at best.
That isn't real. You're playing a surrogate that isn't really a surrogate.
A substitute.
Yeah, that isn't really a substitute. It's not like, oh, God, I'll use them because they're there in my name. We put onto a human something Jesus was only meant to be and to carry.
Right.
And so,
and none other.
And not only does that twist us, because it does, when we have that expectation vested in another human and where they make mistakes and fail and there's all the tragedy, I can't believe our pastor had an affair. And what, 700? You see that? 700 Southern Baptists now have been molested by religious leaders. And the Southern Baptists just admitted that.
That's all?
They've admitted to 700. That's amazing. Do I believe it's more? Yeah, I'm sure it's more. But they've admitted to that. So it's not just a Roman Catholic problem. When you put that on somebody, you become twisted. And what's even worse is what you do to them.
You know.
Oh, you've twisted them into a heap.
Everybody gets twisted in this thing. And I just ended up going like, it was not God's desire.
But it doesn't change. There have been people writing about this for 150 years or probably longer. Right? Every town, every building in this town that's a religious rain shelter claims to have a pastor and treats them. And I have friends who are among those.
Yes.
I do.
Yes.
And I hurt for them. As much as I love them as people, they're fabulous. For the role they have to play, for the game that they're involved in, and most of them wouldn't even consider it a game. Incredibly sincere, trying to do it the best way they know how to do that.
No. And they do, you had mentioned, pastors and PTSD, and I just end up, I kind of hurled at the time going like, yeah, this is all self-inflicted wounds. We're saying yes to something that we should not have said yes to.
Yeah, and we've said yes for 2,000 years.
Yeah, and so for the religious community to think differently is gargantuanly difficult to get them to shed the paradigm.
No, yeah, not they're not going to.
No, they probably are not.
Well, they need the role fulfilled. There's people who want to fulfill the role. There's money involved. All of that distorts the ever getting to reform it. But you mentioned the PTSD thing. We got this. I think it was Greg from Japan wrote me an email. I think I sent it to you because he wanted us both to see it. He was watching a documentary on the type of men who left for Afghanistan. The documentary did a good job of highlighting the reasons why they went, their experiences of disappointment, and the often unhealthy strategies they chose for dealing with PTSD. And I remember this, what he's talking about, I think, from the documentary, and I didn't see it, but you've got people in the altruism of post 9/11 and Al-Qaeda attacking the U.S., and we're going to go in, we're going to serve countrymen, our fellow countrymen have been killed. They're coming at this, not just, we like being professional soldiers and going out and whacking people, but the real call to go out and deal with this threat to liberty in the world. Similar to Vietnam vets, many were left with a feeling that they had been manipulated, used, and betrayed. It struck me that their trajectory is remarkably similar to what happens when someone goes into the professional ministry with a crusader mentality. In this case, one joins the Lord's army and is ready to do great things for God. One sallies forth to save souls and to make the world a better place. But then over time, many find themselves tired. They feel guilty for that they cannot do anymore, and ashamed that out of their own emptiness they can no longer give anymore. They failed to gain the glorious victory they believed had been promised to them by God, and while they had never been killed anyone, in the process of doing great things for God, they hurt themselves and others in very deep, often long-lasting ways. They hit the wall, inwardly wailing, and end up exiting the ministry as they understood it. Their comrades in arms can't understand what has happened. Some will worry out, but many more will end up deciding that the person in question was probably never really one of them in the first place. So I think there's a type of PTSD which can affect people who have not been in physical wars, but have come out of ministry instead. Talks about that kind of thing. Also, I think there's a grab and a saliency, the concept of casualty guilt. It is likely that it would help to explain some of the woundedness of those who've left social groups that exhibit cult-like tendencies. And yes, one can find such tendencies in Orthodox institutions as well. So he's talking about casualty guilt being the parishioners who've been part of that, and particularly in places where they've been captivated and manipulated. Again, the whole thing is having this great passion that seems to be so right, and then having it being so manipulated, exploited, and used in a way that leaves you empty in the end.
I think what's so weird is the great passion that someone typically then directs over a younger life unto, oh, that's what this means, is you must be one of those called ones, that special category, as opposed to you're just a normal believer who is getting excited about the living God, which ought to be a natural response of the human being to the living God.
Right.
That could be wonderful if it was normalized.
Yeah, it would be. Absolutely.
And then it's not the I'm more special than, or I'm more gifted than, I'm now in an exalted place than.
Or I want to get in that position over there, and I'm going to get in my college and do all my stuff so I can get that position I want.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the whole crop of people that are running for president. I wish it was not people that had the ambition for it. I actually wish that somehow you would find the most ably gifted servant and you had to almost convince him to be willing to. I wish that was the case.
Oh, it was for George Washington.
I know.
I loved when we were Mount Vernon. They had a reenacting moment where the guys that there, George Washington, somebody comes in and says, they've just pronounced you president. And he was like, oh, crud. He wanted to just get out of the war, go back to his plantation. He just wanted to live out his life on his farm. That's what he wanted to do. And they came and got him, and then he did it. And so he was willing to relinquish it. And you're right, there's too much ambition behind those who would be our presidents.
And I think the same disease is there right in ministry, where you just go like, golly, why do we want to use the religious things of God for that selfish, exaltating ends, and yet we'll cloak it in the language of servanthood so I really am confused and I get myself twisted?
But that's what we exalt every Sunday morning, right?
I know.
It's on the stage, whether it's now it's as much worship people wanting to get their guitar music, get on there. I want to be up there and watching people move to Jesus while I'm leading them. That's a toxic brew for a 16, 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old. Sometimes 23, 24, 25-year-olds. It is. If you're a music person, you get a gig every Sunday. If you can get a worship pastor's job or a worship leader's job, for the pastor, it's the guy who gets in the pulpit. He gets to say whatever he wants, and people, they're in awe of him, at least as so it appears when you're there. As he talks about
me, I think most people, when they're going, are yawning.
Yeah, well, okay.
I mean, there's very few environments where I think it's actually working like this weird worship thing.
I agree with you, but I think we still play the game that it is. Even if you're bored every Sunday and you sit through that lecture, you still, hey, good sermon, pastor. I mean, you still play that game. This is important. This is valuable. And then when you're in trouble and you need somebody to do a funeral for your relative or friend or whatever, then the pastor, he gets to really be the hero then, because he really is stepping into a very difficult environment and trying to provide some sense of stability and faith and life in it.
Which is it feels, unfortunately, so oftentimes manufactured, and it's like there's so many well-intentioned people that have simply learned the form. They're sincere. I mean, I'm actively engaged in a normal Sunday service, and I look at all these people, and it's like, this is what they have been taught. This is what they have inherited as their expectations. They really do want to know the living God, but this really is the confines under which it's been expressed.
Yeah.
And it's so limiting to their actual engagement of life and the equipping of them to function in a fruitful way, because there's only so many stage roles. And those are the valuable ones.
Yeah.
And so you have this warpage as if, oh, if I was valuable, I'd be one of those. And I just end up going like, that is like the first step towards stupidness. Because it's like, sorry to be so direct.
Catch it just a little bit, would you?
But I just end up going like, that's not the value. The value is our living life with the Lord. And in the 24/7 of it all.
Yeah.
And we have created a secondary veneer of, oh, my religious life is expressed in the services and in the gathered to get, you know, and I'm just going like, that was never Jesus's design.
No, and to some extent, it's an artificial environment, right? And so yes. People have a hard time going from that to
normal life.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and having that, well, it wouldn't be the same, but having the passion to see God make himself known there. And if the guy who's talking on Sundays had all week to prep for his 40-minute deal, what hope have I in just engaging people in conversation where I work? I'm going to be able to help somebody spiritually if I, you know, so I think we get back to some of the stuff we talked before. It becomes about principles expressed in a service. And if you want to get somebody in, you invite them to church and then the church can take care of them. It really didn't give me a way to live out this journey in the reality of the world I live in. And I think that's a lot of people end up on the God journey are people that have kind of seen through that game and can't play it anymore, both from the pastor side of it, being on the stage, being that guy, and yet feeling like inside there, it's warping who they are.
Yeah.
I remember a guy, I've just had lunch with him recently, went from being planting his church, became wonderfully big. He got out of it because it was warping the person he was. That's what he told me. He got the lowest scale job at a nonprofit thing. And he said, you know, I suddenly realized my jokes weren't as funny as they were when I was pastor. People don't treat me the same way they did when I was pastor. I'm the same person, right? But people don't treat me the same way. He got out of the game. And he said, I'm so glad it saved my life. It was warping me into something I wasn't.
Mm.
Just the adulation of the crowd and the eyes looking for you to be what you need to be, whatever, what they need you to be. And yeah, it took it. So we have lots of people who listen to this podcast who both were former pastors and just went, can't do it anymore. We've also have tons of those who are parishioners who were manipulated and exploited and, you know, whose gifts were used for the glory of the church and glory of God and got used up and spit out when they had a journey that had more authentic questions than the group was willing to let them ask.
Yeah, that's the thing that I get really frustrated with, because you end up going like, wait a minute, if this doesn't transfer into the how I live every day, regardless of what I'm doing, then there's something wrong with it. There's something false about it. It's like if it only exists in this service or in the gathered time together, and it doesn't really, or it seems impossible to relate this to what do I do and how do I live a job? How do I, you know, pay my bills? And how do I be a fruitful, engaged, alive human being that is walking with the living God? If it doesn't translate to that, I end up going, why are we doing it?
I'm not. You are. So answer me. Why are you doing it?
No, what I'm trying to do, which is, and it's interesting. I, you know, who knows how they're, I hope no one's listening. Maybe I hope they are listening. The reality is I recognize it is so difficult to, from the context of a service, focus the effort towards producing functional disciples that don't need to be in one. But that's exactly what I'm trying to do.
Right. But that's not their goal.
No, right? I mean, I think unwittingly, they kind of said stuff in that vein. Like, could you help teach us how to have a more meaningful engagement with the Holy Spirit? We're a basic evangelical church. We really come from a denomination that kind of has said the Holy Spirit exists, but we don't really let him loose. Right. And we're actually wanting to experience more of that.
And we generally don't like people like you to come in our churches and teach, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're kind of, you couldn't speak in any other church in that group of people anywhere in the world, most likely. Right?
Probably.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying they're very tightly wound in terms of who they let in and who they don't.
Yeah. And they've let me in, and I've said yes, and
great.
I'm having a really interesting experience, because it's like there's a bunch of people that is like, oh, best ever, and they're really getting it, and then there's a whole bunch of group of people that are like really struggling, like, how's that? I don't think that's biblical, and it's like somehow they're so sure of things that they've never experienced. And they're very, you know, anxious about it.
That's why they haven't experienced them, because they're very sure they're not good.
Yeah, I know. And I end up going like, wow, at the end of the day, I don't want to be someplace that doesn't have the reality of a real relationship with the living God, but bears the name associated with him. Yes, and I'm going like, how can anyone find that satisfying? I really have lost my capacity to understand why people kind of like get their religious itch scratched and are just happy with that.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Yeah. It's kind of like people, we talked about this analogy before. It's a pretty good one though, I think. People who want to get together every Sunday and talk about golf, but actually never take golf clubs out and actually go play it. They want to hear somebody talk about it and, you know, good swings, and here's the big golfers, and you have a whole conversation. Maybe watch on the Golf Channel a whole thing about golf, but actually never even think about getting some clubs, going out to a golf course, hitting a few balls, seeing where this goes. And to me, that's the absurdity of the environment you're talking about. If that environment served people well and got them out playing the game we're talking about here, that would be awesome. But we end up playing a different game. We end up pretending. It's like the one of the use about the life-saving club. You know, they used to rescue people off the coast here where ships crashed and whatever. And they haven't done that for 100 years. But they still meet as the life-saving club. And they have dues and they do all the stuff they do as the life-saving club. But then a shipwreck's out there and they have a clue what to do.
My heart is hurting.
Nobody knows how to swim, for Pete's sake. So nobody's going out there. So they can stand on the rocks and scream, hey, hey, over here. No. No, it's one of the great... It's one of the great frustrations, I think, of my life, because I think an environment like that could be used for some incredible good, but always seems to get sucked away from doing that. And just like even what you described right there, you're coming in, they're asking you to teach some stuff, and some people are going, oh, that sounds awesome. Other people are ready to have you labeled a heretic.
Yeah.
And it's going to cause some kind of internal something.
Yeah.
The group can't survive this, right?
No, either this is the quickest way I get disinvited and bounced out, or it's what's going to split the place.
Yeah, or the bad people go away.
Maybe.
Those are the options, right? Because they're not going to stay there and go, oh, some of you tongue speakers over there. Oh, my God. I mean, that thing. That's what the Baptists did back in 1968 when my family kind of got into the whole charismatic movement. For a while, they try and play with it, going, okay, we don't really like it, but it's okay. We're all one big happy family. And then it was all of a sudden, speaking of tongues is of the devil. It's not even maybe biblical and may or may not gone away. Now it's demonic. It's the only one that Holy Spirit can't do it anymore. Demons can do it. Holy Spirit can't do it.
Yeah.
When it's never given to demons in the Bible, never once, but the Holy Spirit does it frequently, you know, and it's just, but that's where these things go. That's Paul how many synagogues he went to, and they actually liked him when he first showed up. The Jews liked him until
yes.
too many Gentiles came in. And it was like, we're losing our place. This is not what we're here for. We must. And then they stoned Paul and Silas, or Paul and Luke, or Paul and Timothy, or whoever. So, yeah. That's where I'd kind of go, you know, the only way an existing thing gets to reform together is if genuinely at the same time all those people are hungry together. If they're not, then there's going to be some kind of divide between the hungry
and the not.
And the not.
Yeah.
And the complacent, if that's a bad word. You called them stupid earlier. Okay. I'll go with complacent.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I was not offended by it. I'm fine. But that's the challenge. Because in some ways we are playing a game. Can the game be used for good? Yes, it can. Does the game often warp the people playing it? Yes, more often than
not. I think I'm back in my foundational frustration of going, it does feel like a game. It feels like whether you like it or not, this is going to warp itself. Because it is kind of a false dynamic. It's like, as opposed to, I mean, Jesus didn't set up the synagogue system.
No, didn't even use it well.
Yeah. But that's the closest thing we have for why we go to church on Sundays.
Yeah, yes, it is.
Okay?
Yeah.
And it was developed back in the days of the exile, when they were scratching their heads going like, wow, God really let us totally get destroyed and kicked out. And we ought to figure out what we did and why that's the case. And let's try to hold on to a little semblance of who we are. And it's like the priests were then trying to figure out. So we got First and Second Chronicles and the whole.
And the priests needed something to do. They no longer had the temple, right?
Yes.
So they need something to do.
Yeah.
Let's have a weekly meeting.
And so they have weekly meetings and they call it synagogue. And it's like, it's just mini temple things without the temple.
And you know,
without the sacrifice.
Do you notice, I want to finish where you're going here, but let's step back a little bit. When they had the temple, it was only in Jerusalem.
Right.
They didn't feel a need in Galilee or Joppa or anywhere else to like create a weekly mini temple thing, right? Why didn't they feel that need then?
Well, no, there was the argument that when David moved the ark, which God never asked him to, David right. decided to move the ark.
David did a lot of things like that.
And David thought, well, let's have the, I would like to build you a temple. And God's going like, I didn't ask you for a temple. And I don't want a temple.
And I'd like that sunbathing beauty across the hall over there.
Yeah, that was a different one.
That was another thought. David's thoughts were a little.
Yeah, yeah. So you just, but he's a man after God's own heart. Yeah, yeah. That takes a little bit of explanation there too.
Yeah.
But I look at the fact that, you know, the argument that the woman at the well had is one that historically, I don't think a lot of people understand the context. It was like, she's going like, wait a minute. Way back when the ark was here, this is where we were supposed to worship God. And nobody here is clear as to why it got moved to Jerusalem. So we're still worshiping God here as if the here is important.
Right.
Let's not, never mind that she's a prostitute. And it's like, let's talk about where we're supposed to have.
We don't know if she was a prostitute. She was well married.
Okay. In the midst of all of that,
she was maybe a serial monogamist.
sure. I've never heard the term. That's
how some people do monogamy.
Yes, that's good. Serial monogamist. That's good. Snarky, but good.
That's not Cheerios either.
No. But there's Jesus responding to an age-old divide and an argument that you're just going like, okay, it's not the point. God's looking for those that would worship him in spirit and truth. The geography
location is not important.
And you're just going like, okay, so.
But you missed my question. Why did they not have the need to create these services outside Jerusalem?
Because
they had a temple.
I think, unfortunately, a whole bunch of them did not have God in an active element of their life. But I'm hoping that some of them never saw God being limited to what happened at the temple.
Well, and some of, you know, going to the temple three or four times a year
That's
was
it.
Enough.
That's it.
Didn't he do it every week?
No.
Yeah, that would be a godsend right there.
I know. I just sat there going, okay, if that's the whole history, why have we ended up with a temple-centric focus?
Right.
I'm just going like,
great question.
This does not make any biblical sense if we just go, what did God want and what did he exhort them unto and what's going on? He didn't, when the thing gets destroyed, he's not up in heaven like, oh no, better rebuild this.
Yeah.
He's just going, he didn't care.
In fact, he was the first one that suggested, let's just tear this thing down and we'll do it better in 3 days. We'll raise up something better.
Yeah. And I just go like, why do we not recognize that today and realize the whole economics that we have surrounded it?
Yeah.
Is really only has its own self-serving motive.
Wow. You're preaching to the choir. I hear you.
Because I end up going like, that's why we're perpetuating this.
And add that to the fact that there's not one thing Jesus did with the disciples that aimed to that.
I know.
You guys need to really learn how to, what worship Old is services. And leading it and how to prepare a good sermon and how to be the local holy man guru for you. There was not one thing in the history of Jesus, in his story, that says this is what we need over here. What we just need is the temple is the church is a living embodiment of Christ in people who live their lives in the world as a reflection of his glory and in community with each other.
If we don't recognize that we're the living stones that he's fashioning and placing in community with each other,
yeah,
sitting in a building confuses you.
Yeah.
Because you end up going like, well, I know you're saying that, but this – everybody that goes to the building, despite the protestations of whatever sermonizing is going on, everyone leaves the building with the thought that that's the temple.
Great. Yes, they do. And we got to get on to lunch and the football game. And what they're more excited leaving than they were coming in. I know I was at the end of it all. I said, oh, man, glad that's over. Got to get back to my.
You know, the one thing that I am experiencing that I actually really do love is I do love the corporate time of pursuing God together. That's different than just what I do by myself. I have a totally rocking, enjoyable relationship with God that I'm actively thrilled with.
Yeah.
I'm not frustrated as an individual. I have my own times of worship, wonderful times of prayer, love getting lost in the scriptures. All of that's really good. I do miss the gathering together in a way that we are doing right now on a Sunday night.
Mm-hmm.
And the genuine worship of God, where there is a real sense that it's not just, okay, here's the heady thing. Because I got the very first worship leader that I began with. And we've both been run over by a whole bunch of buses. I mean, he is in a non-performance mode. There's just a sense of going like, if this ain't real, we're out of here.
Hmm.
And so there's something really precious about that people are experiencing for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going like, that's really cool. But you still just go like, that is going to be dangerous because that doesn't square with everything else that happens here. And you just go like, oh, I don't know. Lord, do you know what you're doing?
No plan.
I know. I know.
But to answer the question, is there something about calling? Does God, and I like somebody said to me the other day, you know, when I hear of the word calling, I think of invitation. Is great. Is there an invite for God, from God, for certain people to be set aside to help equip people in the body of Christ? And we both said, yeah.
I believe so, yes.
Do we need to cram that into a pastor's vocation in a system of economic self-interest?
No, I think that warps it.
So, is the calling about, yeah. And if you feel like you're one of those, God's kind of given you the desire, equipped you to help equip others to this journey. No, you don't have to start a church. You don't have to go on the mission field. Just start equipping people around you, encouraging, helping. Your gift will make room for you. It doesn't need an institution to find definition.
And it doesn't need a platform to be validated.
In fact, it will work less well on a platform.
Yeah, I think that's where it's like, golly, the what we have done, we've reinstituted an Old Testament temple-centric model. And we have synagogued it.
Yeah.
And I'm going like, none of that was God's idea. None of it.
Yeah. 95% of the teaching I do these days is around a table. It just is. Mostly eating and talking. It's not lecturing. It's just helping people process their journey and open up to something more real. And if they'll do that, man, the world will be changed.
Yes.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.